He is the new voice of talk radio, Alexander Danilov.
Good evening, all. Thank you all so much for tuning back into my show. Recently, you know, I've been doing a little bit more delving back into the history. You know, I've done a lot on my show in the past, but more so getting back into American history and different elements that other people just aren't talking about. And I'm so happy and so pleased and so honored to have my guest on tonight. He's written a ton of great books. The one that we're going to focus on tonight is Washington's Monument and the Fascinating History of the Obelisk. And so many people not only don't know the story of it, but don't really understand much about it, where it came from, what an obelisk is, or any of that. So, and my guest tonight is noted historian John Steele Gordon. John, so blessed to have you on the show tonight. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So congratulations on the book. Again, you've written a ton before. You've written that at length about American history and taking a different look into American history, whether it was the Scarlets of Wall Street or looking at Alexander Hamilton's life and Hamilton's blessing. This one takes a little bit of a different path, and it's talking about something that most people would find boring, except the people that actually care about, you know, how we got to the place we are in the world today and what it all means, the symbolism, all that. So let's delve into what an obelisk is before we delve into why they decided to build this in the middle of a swamp in D.C. So introduce the idea, the wording to it, and where it initially came from.
Well, the obelisk was invented in ancient Egypt, principally in the what's known as the New Kingdom, which ran from around 1500 B.C. to around 1200 B.C. And the Egyptian obelisks were quarried out of granite, a very hard stone, and they were one piece. They were monolithic, which just means, you know, one stone in Greek. And they were exceedingly heavy. They weighed 200, 400, even more tons. They were exceedingly expensive to create and to move and to erect. And they had absolutely no discernible purpose whatsoever, other than, I think, than to prove just how enormously rich and powerful the pharaoh was.
Mm-hmm. Now, early on in the book, I like to read different excerpts from authors I have on. You wrote, the ancient Egyptians lacked even iron tools, let alone steam engines, hydraulic jacks, capstans, and compound pulleys. Their successors, the Romans, Renaissance popes, the status-seeking nations of the 19th century, had more tools available. But building and erecting an obelisk was always a very difficult job with no guarantee of success and a terrible price to pay for failure. So there's a lot to it, right? If you actually, you're either a goat, and by goat, I don't mean the greatest of all time. You're either somebody that people look at and it's like, what is wrong with this person? What a horrible failure. Or you looked at as a hero. And there's always that 50-50 shot of it happening, and more so in the earlier days, even less of a shot of it happening because there's so many variables that come to creating it. So let's talk about why there's such a desire and a passion, because there's so many other ways to do it. The Romans, and other civilizations also built arcs and entries and things like that that they've done. The Spanish did the same thing. But this seems to be something that was almost like a holy grail to build. Was it because of the complexity of it, or is it because that the height that you can reach with these things almost feels like you're reaching to the heavens?
Well, you can reach a higher height using more than one stone. In the fact that they were carved out of a single piece of granite, and that was very important to the Egyptians. The pharaoh Hatshepsut mentions it on one of her obelisks explicitly. This was made from one stone. And the reason for that I can imagine is that it was so difficult to do. Instead of building it out of many stones, when you can build a much taller tower, they built it out of one, just to show that they could do it.
Mm-hmm. So it was more of a just an accomplishment thing, obviously. I mean, ego plays into a lot of things that we've done throughout history, but when it comes to the Washington Monument and what we've been able to do here, we've actually done, I believe, a great job in almost separating ourselves from the rest of the world, ancient empires and things like that. But this is one of those things that obviously we have in common with ancient Egyptians and other ancient civilizations. But this wasn't the first monument that was erected for for George Washington, you know, the founder of our country, first president, all that. And there's so many reasons, obviously, to want to idolize him and immortalize him. But to take us into the first monument that they built back in Maryland, 1827, and why this wasn't good enough.
Well, this was the federal government had called for a monument to George Washington, but they hadn't actually done anything about it. And in 1827, the population of Boonesboro, Maryland, assembled in the town square one morning, went out to a site and built a monument to Washington. It is still there, and you can see it's now in Boonesboro State Park. And it's made of stone, but it looks a bit like an old-fashioned milk bottle. But still, it was the very first monument to George Washington in the country. Mm-hmm. And it was only then that the federal government began to get its act together and to create their own monument.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of it is, and I'm glad, of course, I'm not surprised that you did, but financial is always a problem, not just with federal government, because we know they're not so thrifty ways, John, but because something like this is a big undertaking, and not just engineering-wise or supply-wise, it's a big cost. You need a lot of people. It's a constant project. It's a big project. It's being built in pretty much a swampy area. So there's a lot that goes into it, and you actually start Chapter 3 with, as always, with the Washington National Monument Society, money was in short supply. So let's talk about this, because it seems like whenever there's something that matters or symbolic, whether it was giving money to the troops after, you know, the Revolutionary War, things like that, or other things, there was always it was always tight. Purse strings were always tightened. So let's talk about the financial aspects and the financial constraints of building this and the time it took to actually build this monument, because this wasn't a 1-3 year project. I mean, the Empire State Building was built in a lot quicker time, not just because of the era it was built in, but just because the resources that were pumped into it as well.
Well, when the federal government failed to do much of anything about a monument to Washington, they did commission a statue by Horatio Greenough, who was the leading American sculptor at that time, in 1832, the 100th anniversary of Washington's birth. It took him a few years to make it, and he modeled it on Phidias's statue of Zeus Olympios, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And it shows Washington sitting down in a toga, naked to the waist, with a sword with the hilt out. And everybody who looked at it thought it was either silly or offensive, or both. And mm-hmm. and so it was originally in the rotunda of the Capitol building, and now it's in the Smithsonian Museum of American History on the Mall. So anyway, a group of private citizens founded the Washington Monument Society to build a proper monument to the founder of the country and the father of our country. The original president was John Marshall, the Chief Justice, who had written a 5-volume history of life of Washington. He died very soon afterwards. And they tried to raise money, and they did raise money by the 1840s. They had about $80,000, which was a considerable sum of money in that time. And they decided to start building their monument. They had it designed by Robert Mills, who was one of the very first native-born, formally trained architects. And he designed a monument that consisted of a obelisk shape. He was going to have a star on the top of it, but it was surrounded by a huge pantheon, 250 feet wide and 100 feet high, with a statue of George Washington riding in a chariot. Mm-hmm. He was a very distinguished architect. He designed the Treasury Building in Washington, which is still there, and the National Patent Office, which is still there. It's now a museum. And in 1848, they finally decided they had enough money. And, of course, the first thing they had to do was build the obelisk part. They couldn't build the Pantheon until the obelisk was done. And so they started in 1848. And they got up to about 150 feet by the mid-1850s. And then they ran out of money. And a very strange thing happened. because the society had invited states and cities and organizations to send in stones to be placed on the interior of the Washington Monument, from Utah and what have you. And one of the people who sent a stone was the Pope, Pope Pius IX. And there was a political movement at that time known as the Know-Nothings, who were virulently anti-immigrant and especially anti-Catholic. And they broke into the Washington Monument construction site, stole the Pope's stone, broke it up, and threw the pieces into the Potomac River. They've never been found. Pope John Paul II replaced the stone in the 1980s. Then the Know-Nothings took over the monument. They just seized control of the society. And for a couple of years, until, they abandoned the place. By that time, the Know-Nothings was an ephemeral political movement, and it was rapidly disappearing. And so they gave it back to the society. But by that time, the Civil War was about to break out. And so for almost 20 years, the Washington Monument stood there at 150 feet tall, looking like a stump, while the Civil War raged. And then finally, it was only in 1876, at the centennial of the birth of the country, that Congress was finally just embarrassed by this stump. It would have cost as much to tear it down as it would to complete it. And so Congress, in effect, said, okay, we'll pay for it. But then they brought in a very competent engineer named Thomas Casey, and he decided the foundations were not adequate. And so they had to reinforce the foundations, a very tricky business to do indeed. And then just as they were getting started, the American ambassador to Italy, whose name was George Perkins Marsh, he went around Rome, measured all the Egyptian obelisks that were in Rome. There were 11 in Rome. There were only 6 standing in all of Egypt. The Romans loved Egyptian obelisks, and they kept helping themselves to them. And he found out the proportions were 10 to 1. In other words, the base was one-tenth as wide as the height is. And then the pyramidion, the little pyramid on the top of an obelisk, is at an angle of 73 degrees from the horizontal. And he convinced Thomas Casey to conform the Washington Monument to those proportions. And at this point, it was also decided to abandon the Pantheon because Congress simply wasn't going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And it's fortunate. If you look at a picture of Robert Mills's original conception, it looks kind of silly. The Washington Monument is a monumental piece of work. And so sometimes muddling through ends up with the best results. And so then they did that. They had it absolutely plain, unadorned. They got it finally up in 1884. They got up to the top, and the very peak of the Washington Monument is a pyramid of aluminum, which was at that time very, very expensive. It was at least as expensive as silver.
Mm-hmm. And that was actually where I was going to next. And once again, I'm speaking with John Steele Gordon, leading historian, author of the book we're speaking about tonight, which is Washington's Monument and the Fascinating History of the Obelisk. And the book does a great job of taking you into what the obelisk is, the history of it, why there's such a passion and a fervent to try to build it and continue erecting it throughout civilizations and history. And before I just interrupted you, John, you were about to talk about the capstone, which is actually where I want to go to, and the importance of it, what's written on it. Obviously, you already mentioned the material. So take us into that and the right way, the proper way to cap such a tremendous structure.
Well, one thing they had to consider was lightning protection, because the Washington Monument was then and is today the tallest building in all of Washington, D.C. In fact, by law, you're not allowed to have a building taller than the Washington Monument. Mm-hmm. And so it was certainly going to be hit by lightning, and it certainly was. And so this aluminum cap, aluminum is an excellent conductor of electricity. It was connected to a system that would take it down to the structure of the stairs, so they would carry the lightning down to the ground and disperse it. It turned out that that was not adequate. In fact, with less than a year after the monument was dedicated, it was hit by lightning and caused considerable damage. And so they had to come up with a better system, which they did. They've now actually replaced the lightning system 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, so now we look at what's today, right? So we have all these great obelisks, all these great testaments to great civilizations of past. Do you feel, and this is the part where I often don't ask questions on my show. I usually just do conversation style, John, as you know. But with this, it's important to know, the obelisk, the Washington Monument, do you believe that at some point they're going to actually create something that's going to top that in terms of height? We're looking at 555 feet here. Do you believe there's something else there where it's hubris or whatever it is, whatever leads us to want to do that as a society? Do you think that this is something that, at least maybe for the next 100 years or so, is something that we look back at and say, this is outdated. We need something different, something bigger, something grander. I mean, this is the path throughout history. Do you think that's something that happens here?
I doubt it. One thing, the Washington Monument, is whatever else you can say about it, it is certainly grand and certainly monumental. I mean, to stand at the base of it and look up, it's a really impressive structure.
Yeah, imposing.
It's the tallest stone structure in the world. It's made entirely of stone except for the elevator and the stairway on the interior. And it's very unlikely that there'll ever be a taller stone structure built than the Washington Monument. It was, when it was completed, it was the tallest structure in the world. That didn't last very long. The Eiffel Tower overtook it by 1889. But no, I think the Washington Monument is now so iconic. I mean, it's hard to imagine Washington, D.C. without the Washington Monument. I mean, it's sort of like you can't really imagine Paris without the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so iconic that it'll never be surpassed, certainly not in Washington, D.C.
And there are a lot of parallels there, too, with the Eiffel Tower. They were actually going to knock it down because it was for the World's Fair. My memory serves me correct, because I was actually just in Paris last year. They were actually going to knock it down or just get rid of it or do something else with it other than keep it there. And there's obviously a great story behind that. Not enough time to get into that. But same thing with the Washington Monument. There's a monument that almost wasn't. And the last thing that I like to speak about, John, and again, I appreciate you coming on, writing this book about something that, again, I don't mean it to say with any animosity or in a derogatory way, but this is a topic that you wouldn't expect many people to want to even write about or read about or whatever. But I know there's a big audience for something like this, but I haven't seen a book that takes you as deep into the history of obelisks and things like that. But, and it's something I enjoy, because beyond American history, there's a world history here. There's a psychological history here. Why we do this, why we continue to risk lives to build something like this, why we stake all this capital to do this. And it's very important for us to know, because there's a major part of history. With this capstone, with the top of the monument, there's something written there that's very important. And I'd be foolish to not bring it up. I'd like for you to talk more about that, why it was put at the top of the monument, and it's those two Latin words.
Well, I cannot recall the exact Latin phrase at this point. I believe what it says in English is glory to God.
Yeah. And go ahead.
And this, that, I imagine today you probably wouldn't be able to put that on the top of the Washington Monument.
Unfortunately, you're correct.
But, I mean, there it is, and I don't think they're going to remove it. It also has the names of the people who were responsible for completing the monument, and also who was the president at the time, which was Chester Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
And those are going to stay there forever. One interesting thing about the aluminum peak of the Washington Monument is that after it was constructed, in Philadelphia and then in Tiffany's in New York, it was exhibited before it was installed on the monument. And for a small fee, you could step over it, and then you could claim honestly after a fashion that you had once stepped over the top of the Washington Monument.
Amazing stories, a lot more in this book that we didn't even get a chance to talk about. The book Washington's Monument, and the fascinating history of the obelisk. John Steele Gordon, your website is johnsteelegordon.com. People could check out more. There's an E at the end of Steele for those that that are just being introduced to you for the first time. There's a bunch of other books that you've written as well, and I'd like to mention some of them. Hamilton's Blessing, I mentioned before, An Empire of Wealth, The Scarlet Woman of Wall Street, which I mentioned before, there's a bunch of other books in there, including The Great Game and some others that are out there. I encourage people to check out your website. I encourage people to check out this book and check out some of the Amazon reviews that are out there as well for you. There's a whole ton of them that people can see and understand that you write with a deep passion. You're not a leading historian by accident. You've been doing this for a long time, and we appreciate that you do this and keeping the history of this country alive. It's very rich, and a lot of it is not told. We keep seeing books about the Shot Heard Around the World and the Boston Tea Party and things like that, but there's a lot of other history that makes this country so great and so unique that we don't really have a chance to be exposed to. And this book does a great job of doing that. So again, I appreciate you coming on, talking more about this. And everything else that you've done in writing about the history of the country and even modern day today. I know you wrote some for Freakonomics about the economic implosion, and I know you have a lot to say about that as well, but maybe we'll save that for a different night.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to have been here today.
Thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it, John.
All right.
Thanks so much.